Hey, and welcome to the 6 Minute Mile Podcast. It's a sad truth of our sport that most regular runners will become injured every year, according to a study by Yale University. But that's why people like Brody Sharp have a job. Brody is a physiotherapist who is also a passionate runner. He has treated every imaginable running injury, IT band issues, plantar fasciitis, runner's knee, shin splints, and on and on. Brody is on a one-man mission to work his way out of his day job. You see, he'd much rather help runners prevent injuries than work on curing them after they get hurt. He has pored over libraries of research and translated technical jargon into a collection of blog posts, podcasts, and online courses, all aimed at avoiding the most common running injuries. He is engaging, thoughtful, and approachable. There are plenty of physios who know their stuff, but Brody has a gift for simplifying the complex into usable ideas. We felt very lucky that he gave us the Cliff Notes version of his content, including some interesting takes on why he is not a fan of stretching. Enjoy, and we'll see you out there. So, hey, well, thank you so much for joining us. This is really exciting. We're glad you reached out. And as you know, running injuries, unfortunately, is a big issue for our readers and listeners, and same for yours. And one of the reasons we're really interested in catching up with you is that there are plenty of physios in the world who can talk about rehab and injury prevention, but you also combine that with really thoughtful writing on the subject, and your blog is excellent, and your podcast is really insightful. So that's why we're excited. We could, you could call up any, open the yellow pages and call any physio, but we thought that'd be really good to chat with you because you
absolutely
put a lot of thought into this. So,
yep. And I love this stuff. This is what I do. So, I always love, and just like the topics, I just have a lot of passion around educating the runners and just talking about it. So yeah, thanks for having me on.
Well, good. No, and I know, it's good for your business to have a lot of running injuries, but yeah, bad for the world. But which came first, your interest in running personally or treating runners who were coming to your clinic with injuries?
Well, I was a physio first. So I was a physio and a basketballer. So did that for a couple of years. I used to play basketball when I was a kid. And so that was into my early 20s until I stopped playing basketball. And yeah, it was a couple of years into my physio career that my sister asked me to train for a half marathon. And then so I became a runner and then had the passion after that for treating runners, because I was seeing runners before that, but just didn't have that interest. But as soon as I caught the bug and became a runner, that's when I was like so passionate and then recognized all of these misconceptions that people have and delved into a lot of the research into why runners get injured. And that's where we find ourselves now.
And I want to dive into a lot of specific questions, and I will selfishly feed in a few questions about my own running injuries. So we'll get a lot of good free advice from you. But overall, what is your, at a high level, what's your best piece of advice for runners to avoid injuries? We'll talk about recovering from injuries, but what's the best advice for avoiding injuries?
Number one best advice would be to don't overtrain and don't underrecover. It's like that equation. And some people don't know what overtraining might look like. And overtraining might be, say, acute drastic changes to your running. So it doesn't necessarily need to be mileage. It doesn't necessarily need to be speed. It can be abrupt changes in terrain. It can be abrupt changes in shoe type. Mm. It can be abrupt changes in the way you run. I know I get a lot of people saying, oh, I went for a 5 mile run, but this time I just focused on picking up my legs, or this time I focused on more of a flat foot contact or a midfoot contact, or they're just trying to make subtle changes. But if they do that for 5 miles, that's using your body differently for 5 miles, which actually overloads a different part of your body. So it's acute, abrupt changes that's exceeding the capacity for the body to adapt is essentially why people break down and get injured. But the under recover part of it, you can keep your mileage exactly the same but still have overuse injuries, just because you might be that particular moment in life you have inadequate nutrition or poor sleep or increased levels of stress, and these have all been signs of increase the likelihood of injury because you're just not recovering as well as you usually do.
That's interesting, because most runners know that hey, I shouldn't go from 20 miles a week to 40 miles a week in 1 week. But that's interesting to think about outside of mileage. There could be a lot of other deep factors. So if you wanted to change, so try something new, let's say you wanted to mix in more speed work, what's the right way to approach that? If I want, you know, or your example, I want to do more of a midfoot strike for 5 miles and see how that goes.
Yeah. Runners aren't going to like me here saying this, but you're going to have to be patient. It's going to have to be slow and gradual in whatever way, however quickly the body does adapt. And unfortunately, that's a trial and error. So there's no one set structure for you have to do this for this period of time. Let's just say if we go with the example of changing strides or changing your technique, I would, if depending how big the change is, let's just say you're going from a heel strike and you want a 4 foot strike, I would work on 4 foot strike for 5 minutes and then go back to your normal running. Next time you go for a run, maybe do it for, you know, a couple more minutes, and then we slowly transition in. When I very first started researching all of this, I had my mentor, Jay Fasculier, massive researcher. He recommends if you want to transition to, say, a minimalist shoe, if you're used to a supportive shoe and you want to transition to a minimalist shoe, he recommends adding 1 minute of running in those minimalist shoes every time you go for a run. So your first run, you're only running for 1 minute in those new shoes. And then the second run, you're only running for 2 minutes in those shoes. And that seems so gradual, and you need to be so patient to transition into those shoes. But he's like, hey, this is what we need to do. And that's how we reduce our risk of injury. The more patient you are, the more careful you are, the more you're reducing your risk of injury. And anything you go beyond that, slightly increases the risk of injury, but you're just taking on more risk for that benefit of, you know, adapting to that sooner, if that makes sense.
Tell me if you think this is a good idea. When I ran the New York Marathon a few years ago, I did all my training in sort of mid-sized trainers. And then I decided for race day, I would wear racing flats for 26.2 miles, which I'd never done for more than 6.2 miles. So is that a good idea?
Absolutely not. No, you're going to fall to pieces.
And I did.
Yeah.
Where were you before the race started? No, that's interesting on the shoes, because it is tempting to get a shiny new object, or someone talks you into trying a new pair of shoes and you say, great, I'll go out for 6 miles and see how that feels. But the one minute, that's interesting.
Yeah. I've done the same mistakes. Like when I very first started running, I made all the mistakes in the book, and hopefully we can learn from our mistakes and then like adjust and make those changes in the future. Sometimes people just don't recognize the changes that they make, and so they end up getting injured, but they just don't learn from those mistakes, which I guess this is why we're here and doing these sort of episodes.
You wouldn't have a job if it weren't for people doing foolish things. So be careful what you wish for. We caught up with Jeff Galloway the other day, who's a great guy, and you know, wrote Galloway on Running. And one of his big points now is that he really thinks runners in general should be mixing in a lot more walking with their running. And most runners can't let their egos get to that point. And well, why would I run 6 miles and walk 4 miles? It's gotta be way better to run 10 miles. What's your thought on mixing and running? And do you lose some endurance and conditioning benefit by mixing in walking with your run training?
Well, egos are essentially why people get injured in the first place. It's why they train too hard, because their egos get in the way. And there's been a lot of times when my calves have been getting a little bit stiff, a little bit sore, and then I find a hill in my run and I just walk up it because that's the right thing to do. And even though I have to put my ego in the back seat, that's what's necessary. It's what required. I love doing the run walking, especially someone returning from injury. But there's a ton of strategy to the walk run. Your body adapts a lot quicker. And you'll find that you're able to stay on your feet for longer. You're not getting as tired as much. And so the overall accumulative load can be greater than if you were running in the first place, which allows you to adapt and get stronger. And so that's what I'd highly recommend, the run walk strategy. I think if you don't enjoy it and you really dislike it, then there might be other avenues around it, because we can give people all these things in the world to do to reduce their risk of injury and thrive in running. But if they don't enjoy it, if they don't love it, then there's no real point in doing it. So a lot of runners that I recommend do their run walks, especially if they're returning from injury. They're like, that I just don't do that. I'm a continuous type of person. And I say, give it a try, at least give it a try. You might find that you love it. But if you don't love it, then we can work around some other things, because if they're just hating the whole process, then it's not a right frame of mind. And having a good frame of mind, having a positive frame of mind during their recovery is a big step. And yeah, if they hate cycling or if they hate swimming, you're not going to give that as a an alternative if they can't run, that sort of thing.
And so what would that look like hypothetically for a middle-aged runner? I'm asking this for a friend, not for myself, but if you're coming back from kind of a tweaked knee, some meniscus pain, and if your normal training run, let's say, is 5 or 6 miles a day, what would your recommended run walk ratio look like? If you say, hey, you know, you before you kind of tweaked your knee, you're averaging 5 or 6 miles a day on a normal day. What would that look like? Run walk, is that run a mile, walks 5 miles, or?
It would definitely depend on the individual, like their level of strength, how long they've had time off, how irritable the injury is. And I would justify off that. But if they're just returning back to running, let's just say they've had a couple of weeks off. If it's 2 weeks off, I would say probably do 40% of your volume walking and 60% at a really conservative speed with your running or jogging, and see how that feels. And then we're just basing our decision how we progress off symptoms. So if you're fully recovered and you get back to it, you might throughout the week you might do some continuous stuff, but you also might do some walk run stuff. But if you're returning from a niggle and you want all of those sessions to be a walk run, I would start at somewhere around 50-50. Let's say they've had a couple of months off. I would say somewhere around 50-50 in terms of minutes. So it'd be 5 minutes jogging, 5 minutes walking. And then you're slowly just twisting the equation towards a little bit more running, a little bit more jogging, a little bit less walking.
Right.
And then we're basing it off symptoms. So if you do 50-50 and after the run or the next day, that niggle is particularly irritated more so than what it was the day before or the morning before when you first woke up, that's a sign that what you put the body through has been a bit too much. Like it hasn't really necessarily negotiated the load that you've put it through. So then we need to take that bit of evidence and flip the equation again, perhaps do more walking, less jogging, and then wait and see how it goes. If the knee feels really great and you want to do some more jogging, then we flip the ratio the other way and we're doing a little bit more jogging, a little bit less walking, and just follow the individual as they, because everyone's different. Every injury is different. Every meniscal injury is different. And
right.
Yeah, that's why we're adapting to the individual.
Now, you mentioned you can get to the same load levels or even better levels. Do you think about that in terms of miles covered or time on your feet?
It's usually like calculated by time on feet, and that's because it's like universal. Miles and Ks, like we use kilometers here, but if someone does a 5 mile walk, 5 mile jog, they're definitely spending a lot more time on their feet in the walking part of it. So I don't know. Yeah. I like to work in minutes. I think it's just universal, and I think there's no right or wrong in that scenario, but it's just, I guess, my preferred method.
But I guess my point or my question is, you're still getting benefit out of that walk. I think a lot of runners say, this doesn't feel like I'm working very hard, but your heart rate's still up. You're still up time on feet. You're still building muscle and endurance, correct?
Correct. Yeah. And the benefits come in the recovery part of your run and the recovery part of your week. You don't receive the benefits during the run. You receive the benefits during the recovery, and you're just allowing your body to recover more. And so you're going to bounce back and adapt a lot quicker. And the body just doesn't respond really well if you put yourself through a lot of grind and you put yourself through a lot of torture, or just working really hard, a really elevated heart rate the whole time. If you're not working on recovery and you don't prioritize that recovery part, because that's where the body gets stronger, the body adapts, the body starts to repair all those tissues, and you'll find that you're a lot more fresh. Your legs feel a lot more able to push the top more intense sessions if you are aiding that recovery. And like I said, the walk, jog sessions don't need to be every single session. Doesn't need to be every single day. It can be maybe 2 days out of your 5 day training cycle. But you might find that if you implement that run walk, then when you start to do the high intense sessions, your legs feel more fresh and you're able to perform more of that top tier. So that's what really convinces people and gets them over the line. And I would say, give it a go and try it and see if you feel better for it, because my guess is you most likely will. And yeah, it kind of goes against their philosophy of just trying to work hard the whole time. But you guys have probably known that the bulk of our running training, the bulk of our weekly mileage needs to be low intensity anyway for us to adapt a lot quicker. And that's just another way to implement that.
And you mentioned shoes before and not switching shoe types too abruptly, which makes sense. Do you have some favorite shoes for running, for injury prevention? So, I mean, obviously it depends on, you know, what you're pronate or what your foot shape is or your foot strike looks like, but I will give you my personal bias. I mixed in some use of Hokas starting about 5 years ago, and I'm a big fan. I'm a big disciple. And I think it is, I think years ago there was that Skechers lawsuit, and Skechers was claiming some big health benefits and somebody sued them and they lost this lawsuit. So I think shoe companies have been very reluctant to talk about, hey, that our shoes are safer. But in my experience, you know, sort of those overly cushioned shoes have, for daily training, have paid off, and I feel a lot less stress on back, hips, knees. So what's your experience? Do you like those big cushion trainers? Do you not like them? Are there other shoes that you recommend and think about?
Yeah. So the first part of the question, what type of shoes reduce risk of injury? There's no evidence to show that there's any link to any type of shoe to the generic runner for reducing risk of injury. When it comes to performance, we do recommend lighter shoes. I'm just going off evidence, not my personal preference.
Got it.
Lighter shoes help running economy, and every 100 grams that you take off a shoe will help. I think it's around 5 to 8% with your run economy. So that's quite a big jump. And if someone wants to increase performance, definitely that would be the go. But then we delved into foot shape and pronation, those sort of things. And the research does show that there's no link between the foot shape that you have, the amount of pronation that you have, or the height of your arch compared to what shoe you need. There's just no link to what you'll thrive in and what you'll perform better in and what will reduce your risk of injury. If you have a flat foot, you might benefit from something that has a bit more support, but in the same population, another person with the exact same flat foot won't thrive in that type of shoe. They'll thrive in a different, like more of a minimalist type of shoe. And what I recommend for a lot of runners is just try different shoes and see what feels more comfortable for you. Hopefully you can go for a walk, go for a run in different types of shoes, see what feels most comfortable. And they're the shoes that you're most likely going to thrive in. If we then flip the equation and have an injured runner who's constantly getting, say, knee pain or constantly getting plantar fasciitis or constantly getting something,
right,
we can use the properties of certain shoes to adjust to the individual, but we're not reducing their risk of injury. We're reducing the risk of that particular injury, but we're not reducing loads. We're just shifting it around the body. So for example, if we say someone has plantar fasciitis and they've had it for quite a long time, they want to reduce that risk, I would definitely put them in more supportive shoes, maybe some Hokas, maybe something that has a little bit more of a heel lift, something that offloads that plantar fascia. So then there's not going to be that accumulative load within that structure. However, if you do have those shoes with a higher heel lift, maybe a bit more support, usually they're a little bit heavier. Science will show that the load will climb up towards the knee and towards the hip. So the load will increase in the hip and in the knee, which theoretically increases their risk of injury. If they do like a spike in training or something, it will definitely help their plantar fasciitis, but it will, the load just moves up. And the same thing with a minimalist shoe or like a zero drop. It will take away load from the knee, but will increase the load significantly through the Achilles, calf, plantar fascia, the structures within the foot. And yeah, so we do adapt to the runner if they are injured or if they want to increase performance. But when it comes to the type of shoe, there really is no correlation between foot shape, amount of pronation, and the shoe that's going to reduce your risk of injury.
Very interesting. And so that, to me, would argue for rotating through different styles of shoes, potentially, obviously bearing in mind what you said earlier about not doing abrupt changes, but if different shoe types are loading different parts of the body, to me, it would make sense to rotate that once in a while, or is that flawed logic?
Yeah. I definitely recommend that. I think of becoming more resilient. I'm all about becoming a resilient runner, and whatever the body, whatever the environment will throw at you, you're strong enough to tolerate that. And swapping shoes is definitely a way to do that, because like you said, we're shifting loads. We're strengthening up the feet, we're strengthening up the knees, we're strengthening up the hips if you continuously switch things around. However, if someone loves a type of shoe and they really, really enjoy it, if they don't want to increase running performance, and if they're not injured, they don't need to change because they've adapted to that shoe. And so there's two competing theories. It just depends on preference. If you're happy with the shoe that you're in, you're not injured at the moment, or the injuries that you do have aren't directly correlated to the characteristics of the shoe, then if they don't want to really increase running performance or go with a lighter shoe, then I'd say, look, if you don't want to change shoes and you're happy in that shoe and you love it, then you don't need to swap things out. However, if someone does adapt to a variety of shoes, then they're just going to become more resilient in the long run.
And speaking of resilience, we find that more runners we know than not, will say, I don't need to do weight training. I'm a runner for my lower body. I get plenty of lower body workout through my runs. And maybe once in a great while, I'll mix in a cycling session or something. But debunk us of that myth.
Of course, yeah, I love talking about this. So if anyone can think, if we're talking about resilience, the structures within the body, I call there's like three different buckets, which are three different capacities. One is the endurance bucket. So you want your tendons, ligaments, muscles to really tolerate endurance, because if we're endurance athletes and we need to run for a marathon, they need to have that endurance bucket. The other one is strength, and that's like lifting something heavy. If you can lift that, if you build up the strength in the muscles, ligaments, tendons, then you're increasing your running resilience. And let's just say if you have like a sprint or like a sprint finish at the end of a race or a surge within a race, or you have hills, you have to go up hills, this all requires strength. And if you're training if you're filling up just that endurance bucket, as soon as you do a hill, you're really going to struggle and you're going to increase your likelihood of injury unless you have significant amount of strength. The third bucket is power, or like plyometrics or something along those lines. So it's kind of like strength, but how much you can pick something up, but how fast you can do it. So we're looking at really like explosive kind of movements, and that comes in with the hills and that sort of thing as well. So you want to try and fill up all those buckets to become super resilient. And you also want to challenge the body in different directions. It's not just that one straight line that runners love to run in and have that propulsion in one direction. You also want to challenge your body in different ways and do it in different directions to become more resilient. And strength training is perfect for that. So the advice that I do have, and the evidence is very clear on this, if you want to thrive as a runner, if you want to perform as a runner, to increase your endurance performance, even like your marathon performance, you need to do some strength training. And that strength training does need to be on the heavier side of things. So we're looking at anywhere between the 8 to 12 rep range. Some even recommend even lower than that, like 6 to 8 rep range. So by the time, if you squat, I feel like we need to reiterate and say that when you do go into the gym, you need to make sure you're safe. You need to make sure you don't have that abrupt change, and we're slowly adapting. So if you haven't done any weighted squats in your life or for a while, we're definitely going to have to start slow and possibly start with body weight. But the goal should be to slowly increase and safely increase that weight so that you're able to do, say, the 3 to 4 sets of 10 to 12 rep range. So by 10 weighted squats, you're really struggling. You could probably push out just one more, and then you probably can't get a 12th rep in. Then you rack it up. It's kind of that level of weight what we're aiming for. And that's where we receive a lot of benefits. But what we see a lot of runners do is they say, okay, strength training is good for me. I'm finally going to do it. They go into the gym and they do a whole bunch of body weight stuff.
Right.
They do calf raises, lunges, squats, all body weight. And the rep range is somewhere around 15, 20, 25, sometimes 30. And what they're doing is trying to fill up their endurance bucket when it's already full to the brim because they're an endurance athlete. They're just trying to fill up that endurance that endurance bucket while the strength and the plyometric stuff is just like empty. So I do recommend, and the science does back me up with this, to show that, strength training on the heavier side of things does help not only running performance, but endurance performance. So it's going to help your half marathon time, your marathon time, because it improves running economy. So hopefully that convinces a bunch of runners.
I like it. And if we can't completely convince someone to do a full gym workout two or three times a week on their lower body, what are your favorite two or three or four exercises that you recommend for runners in the gym?
Yeah. And if people feel intimidated or they think it's a big mission to do strength training two or three times a week, you only need to do it twice in order to start to increase your strength. But then you need to do it once in order to maintain that strength, around about that. So sometimes when someone's preparing for a marathon, we like to do strength sessions twice a week to build up their strength, because most of their running mileage, most of their weekly work is going to be running anyway. But twice a week, implementing some strength training. And then when it gets closer to race time, then you only need to do it once a week. It's not going to interrupt your running schedule too much. You're most likely going to do that one session during like another run day. So you get like a rest day, but that's just maintaining the strength that you've gained. So it's really frequency wise, not a whole lot, but in terms of exercise examples, it can be really basic. You need a level of squat. You need some sort of squat. You need some sort of calf raise, definitely. And then it can be potentially like a lunge or like a split squat or a bridge kind of variation. But like I said, if we're time poor or we want to be as effective as we can in the gym, we don't want to do the body weight stuff. We don't want to we don't want to just continue working the endurance bucket or filling that endurance bucket. Do some calf raises, particularly calf raises, either straight leg and bent leg or a half. So I like to do calf raises. I like to do it on a step, but bent knees, and you're keeping the knees bent the entire time. It's only just maybe like 15 to 20 degrees knee bend. But what we're doing is, as soon as you bend that knee, you're biasing the soleus muscle, or you're integrating more of that soleus muscle, which is directly underneath that big gastrocnemius calf muscle. And that is the muscle that really generates a lot of force for runners. But if you do calf raises with a really straight leg, you're not utilizing that soleus muscle. Yeah. It's all that gastrocnemius. And so if you were time poor, I'd definitely do some calf raises. I'd definitely do weighted calf raises with a bent knee. If you're in the gym, they have some nice seated calf raise machines, and you can just go really heavy, load it all up, and you can do that. But I don't go to the gym. I have handheld weights at home. I just rack them up to like 15, 20 kilos, and then I do single leg calf raises on a step with a bent knee, and that really burns my calves. I probably get to about 10 to 12 reps. So I know that's a really nice range before I start to lose quality and I lose that height and I can't do another one. So that's all that's needed, even if you have a home program. But that's the strength component. You probably want to implement some sort of plyometric stuff. So plyo lunges. So you're just bouncing from one lunge to another, like on the same spot, you're jumping up and down, but landing in a lunge and alternating those legs. That could be really nice. Skipping is really nice for the calves and the Achilles for plyometric. So just really springy. You want a really nice, efficient spring. That can be really nice and effective, and you can do that at home as well.
You like those plyometric lunges more than say a box jump?
No, I don't. I don't think one or the other. I think they probably have a place, each of them. I wouldn't prefer one over the other. If I was to give like the accessibility to do plyo lunges, you don't need anything. A lot of people don't really have a box unless they go to a gym. In terms of effectiveness, when you do box jumps, the amount of reps that you can do, say it takes a minute to do 10 reps, where with plyo lunges, you're quickly going from one to the other. Right. So you're covering 10 reps in 10 seconds or a little bit longer. So efficiency wise, I would probably choose the plyo lunges for a time poor or someone who wants to maximize efficiency. But in terms of the type of the benefits you receive from each, it's neither here or there.
And I think about our injury prevention still, you're not a huge fan of stretching, right? And why is that? Yeah, yeah.
Oh,
you mean, our high school gym teachers were wrong?
I would say there's a lot of people that are wrong, but I'm only just going off evidence, and I am actually an advocate for stretching, but it's convincing ourselves of what it actually does, which kind of I need to get the message across. And the evidence shows that static stretching or just stretching in general doesn't do anything to reduce risk of injury for runners. It doesn't do anything to increase running performance. It doesn't do anything for recovery. And so that's all fine. People are saying, why am I doing it? A lot of people stretch because it feels good. And I stretch and I recommend people stretch if it feels good, but we can't convince ourselves of what it's actually achieving. And so what I recommend for runners is try stretching, try going for a run with 5 minutes of stretching, try going for a run with 10 minutes of stretching, try going for a run with no stretching, see what feels better for you. And then just stick to that routine because, you know, people enjoy a stretch. Some people enjoy a stretch anyway. If you are, that's usually for a low intensity, say a weekend long run, something like that. I definitely try that. If you're doing a real intense session, if you're doing like a high intensity hill sprints or something like that, I definitely prioritize a better warm up. That can include maybe some stretches, probably not implementing a lot of static stretches. Do it if it feels good, but you want to prepare the body for what it's about to do. So if you're putting it through a high intense session, then I would recommend doing some dynamic stretches, some like AB skips, you know, like just kind of preparing the body, doing some bounding warm-up exercises because you're going to put your body through a lot. So that's just sensible. However, a lot of people just go for their recreational kind of long run and they think they need to do a whole bunch of stretching when the evidence shows that it just doesn't do anything for reducing risk of injury and increasing running performance. So keep that in mind. And what ticks me off a lot and what people, but why I try to get this message across is because when I talk to a runner and say, oh, how's your running going? And they say, oh, I'm constantly injured, but I know it's because I don't stretch enough. And I hear that so often.
Yeah, I believe
it. What they're doing is they're believing that they get injured because they don't stretch enough, when I know that that's not the case. So why they're actually getting injured is something that they're totally ignoring because they think they're not stretching and they think that stretching's causing these injuries. So they're taking their focus away from something that they're doing that's causing them to be injured. That might be strength training, that might be under recovering, that might just be their training habits, and they're just totally ignoring it. Their focus isn't there because they have this belief that they're getting injured because they don't stretch.
Very interesting. So, I've always heard that if you could only pick one, you would always pick a warm up over a stretch, over a static stretch, right? So,
absolutely,
which makes sense. You don't want to.
And sometimes the warm up itself can just be a jog, and then it can just be a faster jog, and then it can be a slower run, and then you're just slowly increasing your speed. If you're doing, say, just your weekend long run or something that's a little bit faster, maybe like a 5 mile run, it can just be as simple as going for a fast walk, then a slow jog, then a faster jog, then a slower run, and then into your normal tempo speed. That can be a really effective warm up for some.
Love it. And do you like massage therapy? Is that effective? I mean, again, it's like stretching. It feels great, right? I don't know anyone who says, oh, I don't enjoy getting massage therapy, but does the data show that it produces results and prevents injury?
Well, I'm glad you asked this because being a physiotherapist myself, I do a lot of massage. Well, I used to. I now have an online clinic where I only see runners online, but I've spent almost 10 years in a clinic doing massage and release and trigger point release and all this sort of stuff. And on my podcast, literally 2 weeks ago, I had a massage massage therapist.
Listened to it, right?
Yeah. And so Alice was talking about the science around massage and manual therapy. And essentially, it's on the same par as stretching. It feels good. It definitely feels good. It definitely helps calm the mind. And there's a lot of benefits to massage therapy. There's a lot of benefits to this manual therapy, but we can't convince ourselves of what it's trying to do. We can't convince ourselves it's reducing our risk of injury. There's not a lot of evidence to show that there are trigger points that when you press on this area, it releases and you magically align yourself and feel better. There's not a lot of evidence that releasing this muscle will realign your pelvis or your leg length discrepancy, or that sort of thing. There's no evidence to show that massage increases blood circulation or helps like lymph drainage or circulating stuff around the body. And what we do find a lot of benefit from, because it actually reduces, I've spent, you know, 8 years in a physio clinic doing massage. And once you do that massage, they get up and they feel a lot better. They're bouncing around the clinic and they're feeling so much better. So it works, but we just don't know why it works. And we can't convince ourselves of how it works or have someone steer us in the wrong direction. So definitely do it if it feels good for you. There are the type of people that really don't believe it or really don't want to believe it. And then you do a massage and they feel kind of the same. They won't be the type that will seek out massage. However, if someone's stiff and sore, they've had a hard, intense training session and they usually get a massage and just feel so much better. They feel so much better the next day. By all means, get the massage. Don't steer in the wrong direction. It's definitely recommended. Similar to someone who finds a lot of benefit from stretching. Definitely recommended. Don't stop stretching. But it's similar, like I said, if someone convinces themselves that they're getting injured because they're not stretching. Same thing with a massage. If they're convinced, if they're getting a massage like once a week or a couple of times a month because they think that this is what's continuing to reduce their risk of injury, that's where we need to have that conversation. Say, you know what, it's not actually evidence-based. You do the massage because it feels good. You do that massage because you bounce up feeling better. But we still need to highlight the importance of what the research shows, which is around recovery, good quality sleep, having a really well-designed training program, getting some good nutrition, making sure we're managing our stress levels. And that's where the real recovery comes from. You can't not tick those boxes and think that massage is going to solve it.
Good point. So a few years ago, I had a really nasty bout of plantar fasciitis. And I tried everything. I had the boot at night and icing and rolling the sole of my foot. And then finally I went to a massage therapist and they did a lot of work on my upper Achilles, lower calf. And in two sessions, the plantar fasciitis was gone. Now I realized that could be psychosomatic. That could be just coincidence. It was about to go away anyway. But is that in your clinic? Have you seen that? Does that help? Is that effective for that injury?
I've seen tons of plantar fasciitis clients and tons where I release their fascia, I release their foot and they just feel so much better. And it reduces their pain sensitivity and they're able to load up their plantar fascia more when I do that massage. And that's where, like I said, I've spent 8 years in a clinic where massage and manual therapy has been super beneficial and allowed them to do the rehab exercises they need to do. Let's just say you need to do weighted calf raises to get your plantar fascia better. If they're way too sensitive or way too painful to do those exercises, but then we do some manual therapy and their pain levels reduce so that they can do their strength exercises, that's where it could be super beneficial. What it's actually doing though, it's hard to say. We're not releasing things. We're not releasing fascia. We're potentially calming down the central nervous system in a way. People like having their hands-on like treatments. They like being nursed. They like having attention on that area. And if something does provoke a little bit of pain, or maybe there's a little bit of stimulus there that can help calm down the brain and help calm down the central nervous system.
Good point.
So there might be something at play there. And then people just feel better, like training the brain and calming down the brain and thinking, okay, I'm doing the right thing here. I knew I should have got this massage a while ago. Now I'm getting it done. It's going to get better. And just that placebo effect and just having that attention to that area can do amazing things. And hopefully we're not just addressing the manual therapy And because sometimes that issue will come back. Where rehab is really effective is combining manual therapy with long-term solutions, and that being like strength and rehab and those long-term benefits, which the evidence is just like, there's so much, there's a mountain of evidence to show that when you're injured, strength, rehab, like a strength and conditioning program, rehab exercises, this is what gets you better. And this is what, where the long-term benefits are. The long-term benefits aren't from releasing fascia and doing some dry needling, that sort of stuff. It's just the short-term reducing pain and symptoms.
My son is recovering from a pretty nasty shoulder surgery, and he was pretty faithfully doing his PT and working through it. And he finally went in for an MRI. This is probably, I don't know, let's call it 4 months after the surgery. And he was convinced in his mind that the doctor was going to find all sorts of things that were still wrong with the shoulder. Doctor said, nope, actually looks pretty good. Scar tissue is minimal. You just need to work harder and be more diligent in your PT. And he made, in the next 3 weeks, I think he made more progress than he had in the prior 3 months combined, because now he sort of had this confidence and said, okay, well, I'm not going to hurt myself. Things are better. It's healed. There is no obstacle in there. So it sort of goes to your point of, hey, if the massage therapy makes me feel a little better and makes me able to do my exercises more effectively, then it did work. Right. So,
yeah, I had 3 episodes on my podcast around pain science, and how we can like educate ourselves on pain to help ourselves with injuries or rehab and beliefs and that sort of stuff. And this is a classic example. It's changing their beliefs. You said before the scans, he believed that they were going to find a whole bunch of things. There's going to be a lot of scar tissue. There's probably still a lot of damage in there. And just the fact that you're thinking that, and just the fact that you believe that, the brain's going to start sending some pain signals. It's going to be like, don't move it. Don't exercise it. Like there's a lot of damage there. And then as soon as they get the scans and they're encouraged to exercise and encouraged to do these things, the brain's like, oh, actually, you know, maybe it's okay to start doing these exercises. And that's where the real benefits come in. And that's why if someone's injured, if I see a runner that's injured and they're convinced that their injury is not going to get better, they're convinced that if they start running, it's going to snap their tendon. They think they're just going to become so much worse. What's the brain going to think as soon as you start running? It's going to think, what the hell are you doing? We have a leg length discrepancy. We have a hip imbalance. Like as soon as you run, we're going to fall to pieces. And that belief is totally inaccurate, but that's what they believe in. So that's what is true in their mind. And addressing those beliefs and addressing what they believe to be true towards something more helpful and something more encouraging is the first step in a really effective rehab.
Oh, absolutely. No, I've spoken to cancer patients and cancer doctors who will tell you that what's between your ears is the most important part of your recovery, right? When you think that would be very science and molecule based, but oftentimes it's not. So
brain's very powerful.
Yeah. So we've done a good job here of milking you for information without paying you anything or signing up for one of your courses, but we're fascinated by the courses. So talk to us about that. So you've actually got some online courses where specifically tailored for runners around this issue of injury prevention, injury recovery, becoming a stronger, more resilient runner. Talk to us how you started those, what's involved, how can a runner dip their toe in that?
Absolutely. So I have this mission. The mission is to bring clarity and control to every runner. So it's clarity in terms of what the myths are, what the misconceptions are, and it's control over what to do once you're injured or what to do to reduce your risk of injury and identifying all these unhelpful things. So the podcast was the first extension of that. It was me trying to create this medium where I can delve into the research, I can educate runners, I can help them with these universal principles. I can do all these like injury specific topics around plantar fasciitis or high hamstring tendinopathy. It's like, this is what the evidence shows, and had a blast, but just thought, I'm limiting myself with just this audio base. I'm limiting myself when I'm trying to talk about something that might be a little bit complex, but all the terminology that I try to do is addressed to the runner that a runner can understand. And I try and avoid that heavy physio jargon. So I just don't want it to go over my head. I do interview a lot of researchers who like just by default, just get really highly technical and talk about biomechanics and talk about like momentum and all this sort of stuff. And I try and peg them back. And so the the course was just a way for me to provide like something with more visual elements, so we can look at a runner, so we can look at graphs, so we can look at things and try and explain things in a way that's very helpful for a runner to reduce their risk of injury, to know exactly what I've talked about today, stuff around stretching, stuff around increasing performance, stuff around shoes, and then a whole bunch of injury specific topics where we can go, this is what it is, this is the risk factors, this is the most effective treatment, this is what we can do for prevention. And yes, I've built a whole course around that. It's on my website at the moment. I'm going to be moving it to an app pretty soon. I'm going to have like a podcast and blogs and course. So there'll be a lot of free content. There'll be a bit of paid content in there, all housed within one area, because I do have a lot of things going on. I do have a lot of like a 5-day challenge and like an online quiz and like all these sort of things that I've got going on, that I just want to house it in one spot. So within 1 or 2 weeks, maybe when this episode gets released, that app will be available. So yeah.
Oh, good. We'll make sure we'll at least link to the website in the show notes. And that, and pricing seems to be a pretty good bargain compared to the price of an MRI or expensive PT or something. So how do you price the course right now?
Yeah. Well, you can't put a price on education because it's once you have that education, you've got that for life. And so I want to make it really accessible. So at the moment, currently there's it's around about between $60 and $80 per month. If you just want to spend some time just like going onto the course, and once you get access to it, you have all of the information. You have access to all the information, and it's just at what pace you want to go at, what particular topics you want to work on. The first course is around prevention. That's what everyone wants to focus on. So that's the $60. That's all around injury prevention. Then if you are injured, that's when you go to the next course, which focuses on injury prevention as well, but also has a lot of injury specific topics. So if you want to learn about plantar fasciitis or something, then you have that. And then the next extension that I want to do with the next package of the course is, once you've overcome your injury, you want to increase running performance. And so the next layer, the next tier of the course just has a whole ton of it's pretty much all the information I've put together. So it's around prevention, it's around injury, but it's also around performance modules as well. So that's sort of what I've come to. It is very affordable, I'd say. If you don't like the monthly subscriptions, you do have the option to buy it like a one-time payment. So depending on the tier that you go with, it's around $199 or $299 price. And then you've just got that to leisurely peer through. And if perhaps down the track you might get an Achilles issue, and then you can go to that video and be like, oh, what does Brody say about that? And so I'm really pumped that I can provide that information. And it is something, a little bit of an extension from the podcast, but what I find is the podcast is usually the first step. And if people really like the stuff that they're learning and they want to continue or enhance that learning experience, then they can go to the course. But the podcast is obviously the first step.
That's great. So we wanted, you've been very generous with your time and sharing information that normally costs thousands of dollars or cost you hundreds of thousands of dollars to build your own personal education. So, And I'd love to come back and maybe do a second session, because I've got a list of a half dozen injuries, not all half dozen are related to me personally, but I know people would love to dive in more on hamstring recovery or shin splints or IT band issues. But I'd love to wrap up quickly on this session with, you're such an insightful, thoughtful guy, and you obviously take a very methodical approach to this, but I'd love to hit you with a couple of questions that we've hit some of our other podcast guests with, I'm personally keeping a list of some of the answers because they're really interesting. We've talked to some great folks in the running industry. So with your permission, we'll hit you with a couple quick questions before we wrap up.
Bring it on.
All right, man. So first question, what's your favorite book of all time? Doesn't have to be science and medical related.
I'd say Can't Hurt Me, David Goggins.
We're trying to get him as a podcast guest. You probably already have had him on your podcast, but he is.
I haven't. No.
Remarkable guy. What a story. Yeah.
Perhaps on my to-do list.
Oh, that's good stuff. Favorite movie?
I'm not much of a movie buff. Let's say Avengers Endgame.
And my wife would be right on board with you on that one. Morning runner or evening runner?
Definitely morning. I'm just like, I bounce out of bed every morning and tend to wind down when it comes to the evening night. So yeah, definitely morning person.
Good man. Do you run with music or blogs or podcasts playing your ears, or no headphones?
I would say 95% of the time I'm listening to podcasts, and I love learning. I love delving into not only the topics of running, but personal development, business, all that sort of stuff. And so it's very effective to go for a run and invest in knowledge at the same time.
Amen. We agree. Best mentor you've had in your life?
I would probably say my brother. I have had a lot of mentors in the past, but my brother is also like a business owner, entrepreneur. He's actually my twin brother as well, but we live together and we just thrive and like vibe off each other with ideas and inspiration and motivation. So I'd say that.
Very cool. What's his business briefly? Is it anything related to sports?
No. Well, I guess kind of. He's in the life coaching, like personal development, help you achieve your better self, that kind of thing. So links in with running performance and
absolutely
injuries and
mindset, right?
And that sort of stuff. Yeah.
It should be lots of cross-pollinization, right? Between those, your two client bases.
Definitely.
You do that Venn diagram. There's a lot of overlap. If people are interested in both subjects. All right. Last one for you. If you could have dinner with anyone living or dead, one dinner with them, who would you choose?
Still keeping on the personal development side, I'd say Tony Robbins, and he's alive. So that'd be more realistic.
Call him up for the podcast. Maybe he'll do a virtual dinner with you at least.
So, fingers crossed.
Exactly. Well, Brody, thank you so much. This is great stuff. And with your permission, we may reach out to you again. We'd love to dive into, and we've got at least another 45 minutes or an hour of questions. And I think it'd be fun to do a second session to follow up on some of these. And
I'd love to.
After we've read some of the studies you've cited in your blogs and the David Goggins book and some other references you've had, but we can't thank you enough. This is great stuff.
Yeah, I try every day to talk about this sort of stuff, and I get a bit antsy if I don't talk about this sort of stuff. So thanks for providing the avenue for me to get my jitteriness out for the day. And I'll be more than happy to come back on. I love talking about this stuff.
Good way to start the day, right? With a run and a somewhat interesting interview. I'm probably your worst interviewer ever, but anyway. But
we covered a lot of stuff. Yeah, I had a lot of fun.
Good stuff, man. Hey, we can't thank you enough, and we will follow up.
Will do.
All right, take care.